If we could talk about death in normal parlance, in everyday conversations, and not get all choked up, it's one of the sort of last remaining taboos, if you like, that we're not, it's like, don't mention the elephant in the room. But when the person who's dying, and they know their body is starting to fail, they're aware, there is an awareness of it. There might be a conscious trying to kind of block it, but there's definitely an awareness.
Hello and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest today describes her work as helping people to live until they die. Not your normal 9-to-5, but for Laura Coleman, her work as a death doula is more of a vocation than a job. Working as a psychologist and psychotherapist for the Mayo Roscommon Hospice Foundation and in private practice as a play therapist and lecturer, Laura engages in some of the most difficult conversations anyone will ever have around trauma, death and illness. The remarkable thing is that she believes we shouldn't fear those hard conversations because they allow us to live every moment we have. Today's conversation will involve references to illness, suicide, trauma and death. A link to a webpage with relevant helplines will be available in the show notes. Now, you might be forgiven for thinking that this conversation will be a difficult listen, and at times I'm sure it might be, but Laura Coleman, you believe facing the subject of death head on can actually be a really positive thing, don't you?
Absolutely. If we don't talk about death, we can't plan for it. And in my work as a death doula, I'm helping people, the actual patient, but also the family around them. Because what often happens is we all go into protection mode. The parents or the siblings or the spouse are trying to protect the patient because they don't want the patient to think that they're giving up on them, or they don't want the patient to think that they think they're going to die, even though we all know when somebody's been given an end of life diagnosis, they are going to die. And preparing for that just makes that end bit more honest, more intimate.
How did you become a death doula? And just explain the concept. I mean, is it another word for counsellor?
Well, yeah, probably. You could use it in that context. People might know of birth doulas because they've been on the go for years now, in many years. Death doula, really, it's only been sort of, in Ireland, we always had a death doula, but we didn't call it a death doula. There would be people who would come into the house and sit with the person who was dying so that the family could have a rest. And then we would employ people to come in and start us off keening, and they would, so we'd have the keeners. So we in Ireland have a really strong tradition of being healthy around death, like acknowledging it. But then in this sort of middle 20, 30, 40, 50 years or whatever it is, we've sort of taken on the rest of the world's attitude to it and said, don't talk about death. We don't want to be, that's an uncomfortable subject and you're only going to make people feel uncomfortable, so please just don't do that. Whereas it's just reality. And to think that the one thing that we're guaranteed in life that we don't prepare for. Like, it's crazy, really. It's mad, isn't it? That I say it all the time. You'd prepare for a weekend away more than you have prepared for your death. You, have you, Sean? What have you prepared? What's in the notes? There's a book that we have now that says, it's your problem now.
I think about it often enough, but I don't have any preparations. I know there's one particular song I want my kids to sing. They recorded it for my wife's 60th birthday. It's May the Road Rise to Meet You.
Oh, love it. Yeah.
And there's a beautiful recording of it. Oh, and I actually had it played. It was the last thing I did with Today with Sean O'Rourke about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Beyond that, look, you know, and I don't want any of them to talk about me for more than 2 minutes.
Perfect.
But beyond that, I mean, now they know if they're listening to this.
That'll be a task to get them to talk for me for 2 minutes. You've lived a very full life. It's going to be very hard to squeeze that into 2 minutes. Just while we're sitting here and there's just me and you, isn't it a bit unusual that you haven't prepared? You've prepared for your retirement, I'm sure, but you haven't prepared for the absolute inevitable, the absolute guaranteed inevitable. And the reason
I wouldn't want to get into detail is, sure, look, they'll know what to do.
But will they though? We don't prepare people for we're not trained to help people today in this country. We're just not. And so a thing that happens often.
Well, I'm thinking more of the funeral, I suppose, or
exactly,
the aftermath of when it happens. But yeah, I mean, I'd like to think that there will be people around. But I mean, in terms of, sure, you don't know what the circumstances, the facts would be. By the way, I hope we're talking at least 15, if not more, years ahead.
Well, anybody
now,
look,
you know,
at all. And by the look of you, I'd say it'll be more. But but we don't know. And so in my line of work, if somebody is sick at all, I'd say, you know what, it'd be a great time to prepare. So my sister-in-law died from motor neuron disease 2 years ago. Wow. Her son died. You asked me why did I get into the work. Her son, who was my nephew, died at 16. But for both of those people, I was able to prepare them. I was able to help them. There's a lot of things that happen in Irish society around death and dying. We're not as afraid of it, I think, as most people, but it's not a conversation that you want to have over a nice meal. Or so we do have it, like there's something, like when we don't bring kids to funerals, what we're saying is there's something there that might hurt you, or there's something there that won't be good for you, instead of this is the inevitable. I think if we talk to kids in national schools about death and dying, people would live their life more fully because they'd know.
Yeah, but when should the conversation or conversations, plural, when should they start?
As early as possible.
When you're in the whole of your health.
Absolutely. When you're in the whole of your health, death feels like it's so far away. But that's great because you're imagining, I'm not going to die for ages, but I'm prepared if and when it did happen. And the preparation, I suppose, it's that it gives them a little bit of power. This is the last thing that you can do for yourself at the end of your life is prepare your funeral mass or who you want to be there. Or one thing that I encourage people a lot to do is, when the person dies, so we're waiting, we're all around the bedside and we're waiting. I lost my mother, my father, my sister and my brother. All four of them died within 4 years. So we were professional mourners at that stage. Anybody needed anything for a funeral, we had it. And if you get a near call, which I did myself, I had, and that's why I got into the work, I had three small kids. And when I was carrying the third child, I was diagnosed with cancer. My sister had died on the 16th of November. She was 42 and left five kids. And then I was diagnosed on the 22nd of December. And was,
wow, that was quite the blow coming up to Christmas.
Horrendous. A double blow. Couldn't tell my parents. They were literally, after burying their daughter from the exact same cancer, uterine cancer, the exact same cancer only a couple of weeks ago, couldn't tell them. Couldn't tell my sisters. I'm from a big family. There's 11 girls and three boys. But the only one sister I could tell, because I knew she'd keep it to herself. I imagined I was safe enough. But I was anointed twice. And being anointed twice is kind of waking up with the priest over you with the oil is a bit of like, what the hell is going on here? And then knowing that I had three small kids, a three-year-old, a one-and-a-half, and a brand-new baby. And he's at home with them on his own and I'm in Dublin.
What did the anointing, what did it mean to you?
It meant I was dying. In my mind at that time, it meant I was absolutely, they thought I was dying. They were preparing me if I could recover enough to send me to Dublin. And in the meantime, they got the priest to anoint me.
The technical term, I think, for the Catholic churches is the sacrament of the sick to prepare you. It used to be known as extreme unction, I think. back in the day of the green catechism. But, I mean, did it give you comfort? I mean, are you somebody who has a religious belief or a basis for your life?
Absolutely did not give me comfort at all. Sent me into a tailspin. Religion, for me personally, I have my own beliefs. I know that when we die, the body and the spirit or the soul or the essence or the energy or whatever you want to call it, separate. And I know because I've sat with too many people who have had too many experiences for me to deny it. I can't. We don't know for sure if there's an afterlife or not. Nobody can guarantee for sure that there is, but neither can they guarantee for sure that there's not.
Is it easier for people who have a belief in the afterlife and who believe in a heaven and perhaps in a hell as well? Is it easier for them to face death?
In my opinion, it's easier for the people they're leaving behind, but it also makes life a little bit easier for them. So if I was working with you, Sean, and you were end of life, I'd be figuring out what your belief system was, what works for you. So, you know, when somebody...
Well, I'd be saying, for instance, I look forward to meeting my parents, my grandparents, some friends, siblings. Now I have two brothers who died in the last 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
And I believe I will. I mean, can I prove it? Absolutely not.
Exactly.
But it's there, I suppose, ingrained in me since I was, a little boy.
And that eases your suffering. Mm. It eases suffering for you, but also for the people you're leaving behind. Because if you are lucky enough to have health until the end of your life and you die from old age, how amazing is that to die from old age? So if you're lying in the bed and you're dying from old age, it happens too often for us to not tell the family. I would be telling your family. So he may start reaching out, reaching his hands into the air, and you'll be thinking, what is that? What's he doing? It happens too often for it not to be a universal experience. When I tell the family that this can happen, or like so my nephew, he said to me, I think I'm actually going crazy. He was only 16. I think I'm going crazy. And I was like, why? And he said, I think I can see Grandad behind the door. His Grandad was his most recent ancestor today.
Would it happen, for instance, and just to use a phrase that used to be common, a lapsed Catholic or somebody whose belief has kind of been left behind, that they might rediscover it coming close to the end?
Often. I say it myself, I'm just not taking any chances. I'm keeping all my aces covered, just in case. Let's just make sure if there is anything there that we qualify. To be honest, they're some of the most lovely conversations I have, because that's when they're actually at a place where they can talk about not being here anymore.
Do people talk as much about the good things they can and the good memories and things they would have achieved in life as much as they might talk to you about their regrets?
So there's a training that I did, a professor in Vancouver that came up with this training. He's an end-of-life professor, and his name is Harvey Max Chowchinkov. And actually, my youngest daughter lives in Canada, in Vancouver at the minute, and she works at End of Life. She's the one that I was carrying when I thought that neither of us were to survive. She's only 28, but she's working in life. Back to what you said, I do this technique, it's called dignity therapy. And dignity therapy it's kind of like legacy work, where we go back and make sense of their life, make their life have meaning, if possible. You know, so I had worked with a lady, and she said, you know, she never got married. She was a teacher all her life. She never got married, and she thought because she didn't get married that she didn't have a fulfilled life. I said, I'm just thinking about all the thousands of students that you worked with over your life and the impact you've had on them. Teachers have such a huge impact on our children. And so dignity therapy is where we go back through and we'll say, you know, tell me something that you're proud of in your life, or advice that you would leave for the people coming after you, the people you love, or something that was really difficult in your life but that you overcame. And so I record that. And the reason I record it is I ask the questions and they answer the questions. Then I take it away and I remove my voice from it. And now the family have a recording of their loved one's voice. Doesn't matter if they're young or old, they have this recording of their voice. And the reason that I did that is obviously my own experience. My sister-in-law had motor neuron and lost her voice, and for 2.5 years had no voice. And we couldn't find, only the ice bucket challenge, which was really interesting considering she had MND, was the only one we had her normal voice. Now, she was on the radio, she did huge amounts of fundraising, but her voice, she said she sounded like a Dalek. Her voice wasn't like her own voice at the time. So because there's a little thing that we do now at End of Life as well. We offer to people a little QR code that we put on the headstone. And you can, so you come in to the grave and you can click your phone and it brings up videos of them, or maybe little pieces of them talking, or their favourite songs. May the road rise to meet you'll be on yours, I'm sure. So there'll be little bits where it brings.
And you can just put that on a headstone.
It's just a little QR code and you just scan it. And it's a lovely thing. For me, I'm a death doula, so it's very easy for me, but it brings the grave to life. You, instead of looking at a flat picture on the headstone, you see them in your phone. You say, look how much fun she was, or look how much fun he was. You know,
that's a lovely idea. And is it a service that's offered by undertakers and headstone makers?
I suppose
the family has to assemble the content.
Yeah, well, I've been bringing them in from America for years for people, just as a gift. But now they're in Ireland. You know, and I know that death in the first world has been medicalized. Death is a normal part of life. We're supposed to die. We're not supposed to live forever. Yeah. All the Botox in the world won't keep you alive. You know, you're gonna die. But medicalizing it is. So sometimes at the end of life, I prepare the people, because somebody will be in the bed and they'll be dying and they'll be coming near their last breath. And if they're in a hospital, people are watching the monitor as opposed to being with their person, like they will be holding their hands or they might be up close to them. And then what happens when the beep goes, they run out quickly to get the nurse. And that if there was one bit of advice I'd give anybody, I'd say, be prepared for when the person dies to do nothing. Do nothing. Sit there with them. Because for us, the living, for us that are still living, it's such a shock to our system that our soul, spirit, whatever you want to call it, can separate from our body, because my body rushes forward to do something. Oh, I need to do something now. And they're just taking the next step to the next part of whatever this journey is.
How many deaths would you say you have been present at? Because you're at this now for what, 30 years?
25 years with the hospice. 25 years with the hospice since I was diagnosed. So I started working with hospice 3 years after I was diagnosed with cancer. I haven't put a number on it, but a lot.
Like dozens, hundreds?
Oh, definitely in the hundreds. Definitely in the hundreds. I never take it any easier, or this is easy for me. it's a huge loss for the people who are losing this. And I always think of all that's going on in there that's lost now. And that's why I try and get as much of it, capture as much as I can for the family.
Yeah, but you must find as well, a bit like a good doctor, you have to stay detached as well if you're to do the job as opposed to getting caught up emotionally.
I'm going to be 100% honest and say I grieve constantly. I worked with a man recently and I had been working with him for 5 years. And when it came near the end of life, he told me, full of devilment, I had great fun with him. You would have never thought when I'm sitting at his bedside, if you were outside the door, that we were talking about his death, because we'd be having the best of laughs and he'd be telling me all the things that he did in his life that were great fun for him. And then he told me that he wanted to have a living wake. And a living wake, just it was because of devilment, he wanted to have a living wake.
But sure, that could be a great idea.
Well, to be fair, it is at times. Of course it is, because his theory on it was, I don't want everybody coming and telling people that don't even half know me all nice things about me. I'd rather know it myself before I die. And if that's what he wants to do. Now, he did push it and say, could I have the lid of the coffin in the corner with my name and my date of birth on it, and we'll add the other one when it's ready. And I think might be flying a little bit close to the wind, but if you wanted to do that, well, that's what we do.
You mentioned a few moments ago that you're often in a state of grief. So how do you deal with that?
To be a lot of self-care, and you really do need a lot of self-care. When I'm going in and out of houses, I could be going in and out for a year, 2 years. With that man, I started working with him initially at diagnosis, and that was 5 years. And so it's impossible not to. It's, you know, when people have lived a full life, it's lovely work, because their life is coming to a natural end, even if it is with a disease, a progressive disease. If they've had a long life, it's lovely work. It's gentle, you know, leading them and helping them to move towards the next inevitable bit. But younger people is much more difficult. It was one of the things that, one of the reasons I talk about death and dying and talk about my work so much is because we don't have a children's hospice anywhere other than Dublin. There's only, and Laura Lynn is an amazing, they do phenomenal work, but it's impossible to service 26 counties with it. And in Northern Ireland, 6 counties, they have a children's hospice in Derry and also in Newton Arts for 6 counties. And we have 1 for 26. But it just doesn't bear thinking about.
You do have some good news though on that front.
We do, thank God. So the fundraising will be starting near the end of the year for it, almost tied down a site. So that'll be starting near the end of the year for a children's hospice in Castlebar, which then will service obviously Donegal to all the West Coast. It's the most difficult work for me, but I also would sort of say it's my best work. It's where I know I do good work. We lost a child ourselves, a little girl between the two girls, and then I know now it was because of the cancer, but I didn't know at the time. And so I've lived it. So I know the person sitting across from me, I know what they're going through.
You were saying earlier, Laura, that, you know, we should be talking about death when we're in the whole of our health. But typically, at what point do you get called in?
So I never go in unless I'm invited. So and usually it's when there's maybe something a little more complex, maybe somebody who doesn't have family, or there's a dynamic that needs to be worked on with, say, the parent and the child isn't speaking, or my service would be better used when it's complex. But when it comes to the end of life stuff, lots of people who haven't had anything complex just like to do that bit of end of life work, because they know that their family has been left with really lovely memories, advice, with the dignity therapy, that they're able to speak openly when they know they're coming near the end of their life, that they're able to say, you know, I hope you're going to be okay, and I'm going to miss you too, and you know that we can have this lovely open conversation, and I'd like to do this or I'd like to do that. As opposed to, shh, don't say anything, let's just all. I suppose the ones I find most difficult for myself, the people when I'm working at the end of life, are young mothers, because that could have so easily have been me. Mm-hmm. It was my sister. You know, she was a young mother. And when you're sitting at the bedside of a young mother, I genuinely do have such empathy for everybody around them, their kids, their family. And I try and kind of make the work as inclusive of the family members as possible. But it's really important that we include our children in death rituals. Rituals are what we use in our culture. It's like the banks of a river. It keeps a flow. Things can move more gently. We don't overflow. It doesn't, when we were talking about a little bit earlier, when I asked about you, you said, I'm kind of thinking more about the funeral. And the funeral is a ritual that gives us something to do. We know what to do. It's honouring the person. You said only 2 minutes each time to speak. Lovely. That's a lovely thing to have told them in advance. It's, as long as you don't have 10 kids.
How about 6?
6 is enough. So it's still going to be 12 minutes, but But it's the ritual part of the wake. It's such a lovely ritualistic part that we do. We're preparing to say goodbye.
So death is really, it's the great unmentionable, but in fact it should be talked about.
If we could talk about death in normal parlance, in everyday conversations, and not get all choked up, it's one of the sort of last remaining taboos, if you like, that we're not. It's like, don't mention the elephant in the room. But when the person who's dying, and they know their body is starting to fail, they're aware, there is an awareness of it. There might be a conscious trying to kind of block it, but there's definitely an awareness.
There's an element of, if you don't talk about it, there's still some hope.
That's a very, very important and interesting thing that you said there, hope. We never give up hope. There are some miracle recoveries, but they're very few. And if we can be prepared for what the medics are telling us is going to happen, and then for some magical reason, there's a reprieve. Brilliant. The person just knows how to live their life day by day anyway by then. But okay. It doesn't happen too often, John, unfortunately.
More and more we hear people talk about, oh, so-and-so passed.
Yeah.
As opposed to died.
Exactly. It's the language around it. When I'm working, it has to be very clear, very direct. And the person who's actually sick and dying appreciates it so much, because this is the first for them, they feel the first bit of complete honesty. It's out in the open now. Now, if I'm having a bad day, I can say, this isn't fair, or why did it have to be me? If they want to say that, they can do that. But until it's out in the open, we can't start to plan for the rest of whatever bit of life we have left, whether that's years or months.
So you get to the situation where, or the point where we face the facts.
Yeah, and that's to be honest, for me, that's the most honest part of the work. Is I'm not trying to fool you, and I'm not part of the colluding with the family who are only trying their best. They don't want you to think that they're giving up. Like, there's a hope, you said, mentioned earlier, hope. And then there's the opposite of that is hopeless. And who wants to be hopeless? Who wants to have no hope for the person that they love? Of course, they don't want to do that. But there's hope, and then there's reality. And if the reality is that the person is going to die, it's unfair of us to not at least make sure that they know that, so that they can prepare for death. It's the last bit of power you have in your life to prepare. One person that I worked with, all they wanted was pizzas and a few cans of beer with their friends. And before his loved ones came back into the room, he wanted me to be sure and tell them that if he could, he wanted to die at home. And that's what we do in the Mayor Scammon Hospice Foundation. We make it as close to home. If they have to be in the hospice, it's as close to home. They bring their own things. They dress their own beds. But if they can be looked after at home, that's what he wanted.
Do you come across, or have you come across much situations or cases where somebody is dying alone? They have nobody.
The World Health Organization did research back in 2022, and it was about loneliness. And Ireland was the third highest self-reported loneliness. So people say it themselves rather than, I think she might be lonely.
Yeah, I saw reports of that. I was actually taken aback. I thought we would be better than that.
Me too. I remember, I mean, we were young. We were all made to be in the Legion of Mary. Do you remember the Legion of Mary? Mm. Where people would visit people, elderly people. And we were only kids and teenagers. And we'd go and we'd do the shopping for people if they lived on their own. And like, you were designated two or three people that you would call to, and we loved it, and we came out thinking we were great and really did our self-esteem the world of good because we'd done something nice. There's not so much of that anymore.
Yeah, 20% of people in Ireland, according to that, and that was only the end of 2022.
Yeah.
They say frequently they feel lonely all or most
third
of the time.
Highest in Europe. And so that's where I come in. I'm saying that when I work with, I've been working with hospice for a long time, I've found things that work really well. So if I do a bereavement group for widows, I'll do a little bereavement group. It might just be 6 weeks, but what I'm doing is show them how to grieve well. Helping them to grieve well, as opposed to blocking it or pushing it down or not.
How do you grieve well?
The same way as you die well. You talk about it. You can have a good death or a not so good death. My sister was 42 and we were all traumatised because she was so young. She had a long protracted death. Her heart was very strong. At that time, there was no hospice. Mm. She didn't have a hospice. So she was in a general hospital. The doctors would go off the night. We'd have a little SHO and he couldn't up the meds until he spoke to the consultant. Thank God that doesn't happen anymore. Now there is nobody ever needs to worry that there's going to be pain at the end of life now. Medicine has progressed so well that you can live well and be really well medicated and not have to be in pain. Death doesn't have to be awful. It doesn't have to be awful. It can be gentle, and it can be a release, and it can be soft, and we can be there letting the person go.
You talked about training in Canada, and your daughter's now working there in the same area. Mm. I wonder what your opinion is on the whole idea of assisted dying, because they have that in Canada for a number of years, and it's something like 1 in 20, about 5% of deaths there are as a result of assisted dying.
Yeah, and I've never worked with anybody myself that wanted assisted dying. I did work with one lady, and she wanted euthanasia, but she got too sick too quick, and it couldn't happen. Mm. The thing is, I suppose it's the last piece of control, but often what happens now, even I know this in Canada because my daughter works in that area, and she works in a Catholic hospital, so they prepare people there, but they don't do euthanasia in that hospital. They have to go to another hospital. And the work that she does is so lovely. It's literally making the end of their life very memorable. Mm-hmm. Everything they want to do, she's put people into a wheelchair that weren't able to get into a wheelchair, put them into a wheelchair, took them for a walk in the park, went to Kentucky Fried Chicken, like she did, because that was their favourite meal, brought them in apple pie and cream, because that's what they get to plan for the end of it. And if you're not going to get better, now this is only a personal opinion, but if you know you're not going to get better, and if you are afraid that your life is going to be traumatic near the end, in this country that's not going to happen anymore. That's why people look for MAID. That's why they look for medically assisted dying. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's sad because people that are left behind, but the medics can do wonderful work to make the end of life way more peaceful.
It is something that's it was on the agenda in the last all. It may or may not return the idea of legislating for it in this country. I mean, how would you see your own role, or would you just decline to have anything to do with it in the event of it being an option in this country?
I would definitely help people if it was going to help. So I don't think, like any other thing, I don't think because it's legislated for that everybody's going to want to do it. But for the people who feel that that would be an easier choice to die that way, well, then I think it's an option. If it's an option, people can choose. And so when I think about it, I think what people are trying to avoid is suffering. Mm. So if somebody said to me, I really want to have medically assisted death, then I'd be saying, okay, so what I want to know first, what I'd be trying to get to is, what I want to know first is, why is it that you want to be gone? Mm-hmm. So what is it that's causing you to not want to live out the rest of your life? If it's fear of pain, that can be sorted. Or is it something else? Is it something deeper? Is it the person actually wants a suicide as such? Because medically assisted dying is suicide, really, except they don't do it themselves. But there's a reason why a person would want that. There's something behind it, like there's something under it, rather than saying, OK, so let's see if you qualify. Technically, you qualify by law to be able to have this. For me, I wouldn't be going there first. I'd be going, why is it that you don't want to live the rest of this life if we can almost assure you that it's going to be fairly pain-free? You know, what is it that you don't want? So that's where I'd be going first. And then with psychotherapy, worked out what was going on there. I would think that a lot of the time that you'd probably end up in a position where the person actually could work through the reasons they wanted to die sooner.
What about situations where, if you like, the relationship has deteriorated in the family, either between two adults or parent and children? Yeah. How can you help much in those situations?
I genuinely think that might be one of my key skills, is being able to help people reconnect. I'm really good at it. I'm not bragging, but I genuinely am. I've done it so many times that I can. It can be delicate, but it can be done. And if we don't try, it definitely can't be done. Nothing changes if you don't try.
How did COVID affect your work?
To be honest, even now, I still don't know if it was the best work I did or the worst work I've done. I was in hazmat suits in a garden, speaking through a window to a person in the bed who's end of life, talking to me through the window. It was awful, really. Mm. It was awful. They missed out on that human touch. I couldn't sit down at the side of the bed and hold a person's hand, which is my natural go-to. I'm a tactile human being, you know, and we do well when we get gentle touch. Our body produces oxytocin. It's a love chemical. It's a happy chemical. And just from holding a person's hand, they get a release of oxytocin. It doesn't have to be, you know, a full-on hug like I gave you earlier. But so COVID was tough, very tough for me.
And
absolutely.
obviously it leaves the surviving relatives. They didn't get a chance to say a proper goodbye.
We didn't get the rituals. We didn't get the wake. And so what happened for people who lost loved ones during COVID, for months and months and months and maybe years, they're still meeting people. And so instead of having done the file through at the wake, they now have to, every time they go to the shop, they meet somebody. It's a different type of grief work that I'm doing with people there. Not everybody needs support grieving. Grieving's a normal, natural part of life, and not everybody needs support with it. But for the people who do, it's nice that the service is there and available for them to show them how to grieve well. So you can die well and you can grieve well.
Would you often have, say, you know, a row might break out around the deathbed, might have something to do with a will or property or money or something?
And you know what I notice? And this is genuinely, the more preparation that's done before the death, the less hassle, the less trouble, the less fallouts after the death. The finest of families can fall out over property. When we're openly talking about that the person's going to die, now the person can openly talk about their wishes and what they want and what they don't want. And it's very important. It's even more important what they don't want to happen. I said, I don't want this and I don't want that and I don't want people, you know, going up and talking for 10 minutes about me.
I want to ask you now, just to broaden the conversation, Laura, about your work as a play therapist, because you know, you're a psychotherapist, as you say. You work a lot with children. What, that doesn't necessarily involve grief or death situations.
Oh, can do, yeah. Of
course, yeah, but it doesn't always. But,
I mean, no, not always.
How broad is your brief is really what I'm asking.
In private practice, I'd be working with children with who would be suffering from anxiety, or children who would have disordered eating, or I kind of work more near the heavy stuff, you know, children who would report as suicidal or who would have been self-harming. So I do a lot of work around that and disordered eating. Whoever wants me, there's a waiting list and I see them. If we can help children figure out how to manage big feelings and manage tough situations in their life, they have those skills and tools for the rest of their life. I don't need to come back to them again when they're a teenager. And as a man, it's an awful lot easier to build up a child than it is to try and help a man repair the damage that was done when he was a child.
Youngsters growing up now, they, unlike people of our generation, mine and perhaps yours as well, they're dealing with things that we never had to bother with or be concerned or influenced by social media.
Absolutely. The thing is that if a child is vulnerable, then whatever they see in social media or whatever they go looking on social media will trigger that vulnerability. If a child didn't have that vulnerability in the first place, well, then they'll navigate social media knowing that Instagram is fake and knowing that it's just a screenshot of 1 second in their life that they prepared 2 hours for to look like that. And they'll understand that. But if there's a vulnerability there, it can show up through being influenced by social media. And what I'd be doing is not telling them that they can't use social media, or not telling them that they can't do this or can't do that. I'd be saying you need to have skills and be discerning around what you're looking at, what you're taking in, how you're managing that. To me, they need skills to navigate it rather than avoid it, because something else will come along.
In another podcast conversation I had with Colm O'Rourke, famous Meath footballer, retired just recently as principal of a big school in Navan, he was saying that parents haven't much of a clue about, even the savvy ones, about what their kids are engaging with online and so forth. Would that be your experience too?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, absolutely. Part of my other work is that I do parenting classes for parents of adolescents, specifically adolescents, because it's a very different part. You had this lovely baby, the baby was replaced by this lovely little toddler. You had this lovely toddler who was replaced by a child, and then this child is replaced by this entity that is an adolescent that can be really hard to figure out. Some kids sail through adolescence, but most struggle on some level. So I do a parenting class, I do it in schools. So I'll go in and I do it with the parents of first years, just to give them the heads up as to what to expect. You know, the parents, if I showed a parent a vape, and if the vape had HTC in it, or if it had the one with the cannabis in it, I wouldn't be able to tell the difference. Only for teenagers, show them. Tell me the difference. But the parent wouldn't. They'd think that was just the bubblegum flavoured vape. It's a kind of an educational thing that I do. But I do it through schools because you get a bigger audience. When a parent comes to me for a private sessions with their child, that's a different kettle of fish. I'm preaching to the choir then. They want to know. But some people, head in the sand, if he's not causing any trouble, if she's not getting into bother, we must be doing okay. One thing that I'll say to parents is, have you taught your child how to problem solve? So they come up with, it doesn't matter what the problem is, have you taught them how to problem solve? And inevitably they'll say, no, but like, sure he should know. And I'm like, who do you think in his life would teach him how to navigate tough situations? There's one thing that I use every single parenting class, I'll say, you need to have a code with your teen, because a lot of teenagers that I work with don't want to find themselves in those tricky situations. They don't want to find themselves there.
For example,
drinking, or you know, somebody offering them drugs or sex. 13-year-old telling me that she's had sex. It's frightening. And her parents didn't know. Obviously, they need to know. So this code is that you between you decide on an emoji. Any emoji, can be thumbs up emoji, can be, you know, heart, can be any emoji. But that when your child sends you that emoji, that's their code to let you know, I want out. I need you to come and collect me. The key to it is when you go and collect them, you don't ask questions. Because if you ask questions, you're going to have to do something about it. You're an adult. Every adult in this country is mandated. If we know that children are in trouble, or that are being treated badly, or that there's something wrong going on, every one of us were obliged to respond. So when that child sends an emoji, mommy can ring and say, you have to come home. I'm going to come and pick you up. And then they can go, "What? That's not fair. Why are you making me come home?" So they don't lose face with their friends, because for adolescents look out. They don't look, the parent now is secondary. Their peers now are their primary people that they need to impress. Where they used to think that mommy was great, that wears off very quickly in adolescence. And so when you have a child that's, inverted commas, a good child that doesn't want to get into trouble, and they don't have a way out that lets them keep face with their friends. So when I said to the parents, I say, I have to do it with the adolescent. So this is an agreement. When they send you this text, you immediately ring and say, you have to come home.
But that's fine if it works. But
yeah, and it does work. I've seen it work so well.
There's a lot of discussion in fairly recent times about a series on Netflix about, it's called Adolescence.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's something that even the British Prime Minister is saying. We hear Simon Harris, the tallest in this country, saying we need to look at this. It needs to be watched widely in schools and by mm-hmm. parents and so forth. What are your thoughts?
So my feeling on it is this. That child, I know it's a fictional character, I'm assuming. I do think social media has a lot to answer for. And we're shown, kids are seeing things that are horrific. Like for me, it's if a child is being influenced by social media, their own internal, there's something internal not right themselves. Mm-hmm. There's some vulnerability, there's some little thing that needs attention. If they're not, we'll say, clear enough that this is fake, this is people pretending.
How do you get children to open up though?
They want to open up. They literally want to open up. Now I know when they come to me, I'm like, they don't know where to put me. They don't know, is she a doctor? Is she a teacher? Is she a mummy? Who is she? What is she? They don't know which category to put me in. Mm. And they kind of sort of spread me out over them all. But children who ask to come, or whose parent wants them to come, they want to talk. They want to get sorted. They want help. They want help to work out whatever it is that's going on the inside that's making their external world unhappy. And when they show you, believe them. Often a parent will say to me, I think she's only doing it for attention. And if she's doing it for attention, she needs attention. If your daughter or your son is doing something for attention, there's your cue. They need attention. Mm-hmm. And so what they want is they want good attention if at all possible. But if they don't get that, they'll take any attention.
To conclude, let's go back to where we started. What are your own thoughts about your own debt?
To be fair, I think I'm lucky that I'm one of the people that I have no fear of death. Mm. I have absolutely no fear of death. If my time's up in the morning, I'm ready. And if it's not, now I have a few little things planned that, you know, that might throw a little curveball to the people that are left behind. I have a book, and on the cover it says, it's your problem now, and because I'm dead. It's a notebook. It's a notebook where I've written all the things that if I don't get a chance, please God, I'll get a chance to have grandchildren. But if I don't get a chance to have grandchildren, that I'll have, these are things I want you to say to my grandchildren and tell them I would have said that if I was here.
Laura, to change the words around of St. Augustine, Lord grant us a happy death, but not yet.
Not yet, exactly. Love it.
Lovely talking to you, Laura Coleman. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.